The call came in during the late afternoon, when the South Carolina sun was just beginning to cast long, distorted shadows across the suburban lawns of Rock Hill. My radio crackled with a report of shots fired on Marshall Road, but the initial dispatch could not have prepared us for the scene waiting behind the tree line of that quiet driveway. When I arrived, the air was heavy and still, broken only by the rhythmic thrum of an idling service van parked near the residence. The first thing I noted was the smell of spent gunpowder mixing with the scent of freshly cut grass from a neighboring yard. Two men lay near their vehicles, their tools scattered in the dirt like discarded toys. They had been there to fix an air conditioning unit, caught in a crossfire that felt entirely out of place in this neighborhood of brick homes and manicured gardens. Moving toward the back of the house, the silence was suffocating. We found the rear entry breached, and as we cleared the rooms, the scale of the tragedy expanded into every corner of the home. It was a scene of clinical, terrifying efficiency. I stood in a hallway where the life of a prominent local doctor, his wife, and two small children had been ended in a matter of seconds. I looked at the floor and saw the spent casings glinting in the light. In that moment, I did not have a name for the person responsible, but I knew we were hunting someone who moved with a singular, violent purpose. The suspect was Philip Adams. The initial investigation moved with a speed dictated by the evidence left behind at the Marshall Road property. As I moved through the crime scene with the forensics team, we located a discarded cellular phone that did not belong to any of the victims. A quick check of the device and a canvas of the immediate area pointed directly to a residence less than a mile away. The suspect was a former professional athlete, a man who had spent years as a cornerback in the National Football League. We established a perimeter around his family home as the sun went down, transforming the quiet residential street into a theater of floodlights and tactical gear. I watched from the command post as negotiators attempted to make contact with the individual inside. We evacuated his parents to ensure their safety, while a loudspeaker blared requests for a peaceful surrender into the dark. There was no response from within the house, only a heavy, expectant silence that lasted for hours. We deployed a robotic unit to scan the interior of the home, moving it floor by floor to locate the suspect without putting more officers in the line of fire. Around midnight, a single muffled shot was heard by a neighbor, though it did not register clearly on our perimeter microphones. When we finally breached the bedroom at 2:30 in the morning, we found the suspect dead from a self-inflicted wound. He was surrounded by the same caliber of weaponry used at the first scene. We recovered a .45 caliber handgun and a 9mm firearm. The physical manhunt was over, but the reconstruction of the timeline was just beginning. We learned that the suspect had been struggling with significant mental health challenges in the months leading up to the shooting. His family reported that his temperament had shifted from laid back to volatile with little warning. He had begun to isolate himself and neglected his personal hygiene. Investigators found a collection of notebooks in his possession, filled with cryptic designs and emblems. The writings were incoherent, suggesting a mind that was rapidly fracturing. There was no clear motive found in these pages, only evidence of a deteriorating internal world. The focus of our forensic inquiry shifted from the ballistics to the digital and biological evidence recovered from the suspect. While the guns told us how the crime was committed, we looked to the medical history to understand the catalyst for such an extreme departure from his known character. Forensic toxicology reports confirmed the presence of amphetamines in his system, for which he had a valid prescription, along with kratom, an over-the-counter stimulant. However, the most significant evidence came months later, following a specialized autopsy of the suspect's brain. Neuropathologists at Boston University conducted a post-mortem study that revealed a stage 2 case of chronic traumatic encephalopathy. This degenerative disease is linked to repetitive head trauma and is frequently seen in athletes who have played contact sports for decades. I reviewed the findings, which indicated that the damage was unusually severe in the frontal lobes of his brain. This specific area of the brain is responsible for executive function, impulse control, and the regulation of behavior. The atrophy and protein accumulation found in his frontal lobes were compared in severity to other high-profile cases of athletes who committed acts of extreme violence. The medical experts explained that this level of pathology often results in paranoia, aggression, and a complete loss of self-control. This data provided a technical framework for the incoherent notebooks we had seized during the initial search. The cryptic emblems and fragmented thoughts were physical manifestations of a brain that was physically shrinking. We traced his career back 21 years to when he first started playing tackle football at the age of 7. During his professional career, he had suffered at least 2 documented concussions within a 3-week period in 2012. His family had tried to seek assistance from the league for his declining memory and physical pain, but those claims were denied. The forensic evidence suggested that the suspect was not merely a criminal actor, but a man functioning with a compromised neurological system. The frontal lobe damage created a lowered threshold for violence that likely made his actions on that April afternoon an inevitability of his condition.